Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show. This week's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by McAfee and hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. And it's also coming to you from a very echoey room at a friend's place in Sydney. I've come down here for a couple of interviews. This week's podcast is another big one. We'll be hearing from one of the most respected minds in IT security, HD Moore. Some know him as the creator of the Metasploit framework, but after today's Risky Business interview, you'll remember him as the creator of the world's most evil EPC. Cryptic, I know, but stay tuned to hear all about HD's evil creation. You'll never use wireless again. We also hear from Art Cavellio on this week's show. He's a security veteran and president of RSA Security. He spent a significant part of our interview tearing strips off security super pundit Bruce Schneier.
Bruce talks out of both sides of his mouth. He'll tell you you can't have a perfect security system, and then when he sees any flaw in the system, he says, well, you might as well not even have it. So which is it, Bruce?
That's coming up soon. We'll also check in with McAfee's Dave Marcus, who stopped by to mark the 30th anniversary of Spam in this week's sponsor interview. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news headlines with ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Cataria. And Mania, if you're an Italian, it looks like it would be easy for us to look up your income on the intertubes.
How great is this? It seems like just before the election, the government decided it was a brilliant idea to, as part of a crackdown on tax evasion, is publish everyone's income on the country's tax website.
Yeah, now it's one of those groovy left-leaning governments that's been voted out. So it was what it did on its last day of office is posted every Italian citizen's income details. Now, of course, this website proved hugely popular, with surprised Italians delighted at the chance to find out how much their neighbours, colleagues and high-profile celebrities were earning, bombarded the site within hours of it going live. But sanity has prevailed and they've pulled it offline since.
Do you know what? I think it's a brilliant idea because we have all of these issues like data disclosure laws and, you know, what, we don't need to worry about that if we publish everything online and then just let the bad guys try and, you know, search through the crap.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, this happens in the UK and it's a massive scandal. When it happens in Italy, it's the government meant to do it.
It's a brilliant, it's a great way of bypassing it. It's like, yeah, we thought it would be a good idea. So there you go, it's done now.
Yeah, okay.
What are you going to do about it?
That's it. But looks like they might have actually violated their own privacy laws. But we should point out that the reason the government did this is they were very frustrated with the high level of tax evasion in Italy. So this move was a part of a sort of name and shame crackdown on tax evasion.
Do you reckon it'll help?
Well, I don't think anything really helps. I don't think anything helps stop people from trying to avoid paying tax. But you know, that's just my little interpretation of history.
Yeah, I'd like to see them do it over here, actually. I think it'd be a fun read.
Yeah, well, we'd still get to see, well, if he was still alive, Kerry Packer earning his, what is it, $1 a year or whatever it was that he used to declare.
Yeah.
Now, this is a little bit interesting considering the topic of last week's Risky Business, on which we had Simon Howard from the Race to Zero competition on the show defending his Race to Zero virus obfuscation challenge. But it looks like at Blue Hat, antivirus technology or the flaws in antivirus technology have been a big feature of that conference.
Yeah, that's right. And they're looking, I mean, you know, we've got this guy, I can't say his name, Kaminsky. Kaminsky, is that right?
Oh, yes. Dan Kaminsky, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, he's saying we all know that antivirus is broken. It's like, yes, we've known that for a couple of years now. But he's talking about how, you know, just how easy it is to actually make antivirus software fall over.
Yeah, well, what I find funny about this is that when my buddies, you know, Simon, including Simon Howard, try to do this, people call them cyber terrorists. But when someone does it at a security conference sponsored by Microsoft, it's very they're very sagely words that everyone should listen to.
Yeah, and there's, in this story, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the antivirus apps having a whole lot of flaws and whatever, but they don't actually mention any at all in there. I'd really like to know which ones they were talking about.
Well, Feng Zhu, also known as SoWhat, did a bunch of research with Nevis Networks and found a bunch of vulnerabilities, actually, in antivirus products. So there you go.
Yeah. This one, one of the things that Zoo says is how sending an infected file to someone, and you know that returns a reply and specifies which antivirus product has scanned that file, and then if you know the exploits for that one, you just go back again and then you bypass it. It's simple, but you know, very effective.
Well,
like that.
So much for obscurity. I mean, I think the point there was that security software often advertises its presence, which is kind of silly.
It's just not smart at all. Yeah.
Now, in other news, British Aerospace has got an $8.5 million contract to lock down a mobile military network.
That's right. It's BAE, and basically they're working with DARPA, or for DARPA, right, to develop an intrinsically secure mobile network for using planes, ground vehicles, and sensor systems, as well as in handheld devices.
We should point out that DARPA is the American military's sort of evil genius wing.
I've never heard them called that.
Well, they are. I mean, that's where they make, you know, killer robots and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
High-tech military application sort of wing, and very much focused on research. But this thing's called mobile ad hoc network, so it's like a peer-to-peer network where everything's supposed to be secure. And I'm really hoping they're not going to try to run this on IP.
I tell you what, I don't know what else they're good at, but they're brilliant at coming up with names. They've called this, and the acronym is IAMANET. It's fantastic.
That is intrinsically assurable mobile ad hoc networking. Now that is acronym creation at its best, isn't it?
It is. It's brilliant. They must have spent months on that.
What is it? Which company was it that spent? Was it PricewaterhouseCoopers or Accenture? It was one of those guys, wasn't it? That spent, you know, some ridiculous amount of money, like $10 million, on to come up with some new logo.
Is that the one where you turned it on its side?
And they removed the dot from the eye or something like that. Reminds me of that scene from Zoolander when they say, what is it, this guy is so hot he could take a turd and wrap it in tinfoil, hang a couple of hooks on it and give it to the queen as earrings. There you go. So there you go. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with. I mean, the shame that it's a military project is that it's unlikely we'll get much of a look into what they come up with. But I suppose a lot of military security research winds up eventually trickling into the public domain, so...
Yeah, definitely. So I reckon give it 10, 15 years, we may see some of what comes out of this.
10 or 15 years, and we may know what that last story was about.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this isn't technically a security story, but I thought it would be of interest to the listeners, which is why I picked it out. But Sydney has, well, the New South Wales government has scrapped plans for a free Wi-Fi network in the Sydney CBD.
That's right. It wasn't just Sydney. There's going to be a few other places as well, Newcastle, Liverpool, Wollongong, and Parramatta and Penrith as well. But yeah, they've decided to ditch it, and they're saying that they've scrapped it because it hasn't worked in other countries and it's going to cost too much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, dude, it's free Wi-Fi. Yes, it's going to cost a lot, but come on.
Come on, we want it because we're sick of having to pay for Wi-Fi at Starbucks.
How good would it be if you could just like wander around and have Wi-Fi over? I mean, the security risks are huge, I bet, but it was a great idea. I can't believe they got rid of it.
Well, mate, when you hear my interview with HD Moore on today's podcast, you're never going to use Wi-Fi again anyway, so it doesn't...
I look forward to that one.
Oh, my God, it's frightening stuff, but there you go. Yeah. Now, in this next item, which comes from securityfocus.com, and the reason I picked this out is it's not technically a security story, but it's one that's definitely going to be of interest to our listeners. If you're going to the US... you should really think about leaving your laptop at home because they've deemed, and not only has the US deemed this to be legal, but Australia has as well, but customs can just search through your hard drive.
And they can make a backup copy of it just so they can search through afterwards. It's just ridiculous. So you go in there with a laptop. Before there was a thing where, you know, when all the security stuff first kicked off, they'd make you switch it on just to make sure it was actually a working laptop. And, you know, that was really scary if your batteries had run out and you'd really wonder what was going on. Here, yeah, they can actually get you to switch it on and go through all of your stuff. It's just nuts.
No, it's horrible. I mean, they do it in the name of protecting children from pornography and all of that. But, I mean, the idea that they can just randomly search through your, you know, I consider my laptop to be like an electronic brain, I guess. You know, it's an extension of my mind. And I don't want some grubby TSA moron pouring through it with his blunt little intellect.
There's some really, really... just imagine, you could have all your intellect property. I mean, you know, for you, you store your podcasts and that kind of thing on there, and they could go through them, they could listen to your interviews, and they could copy them and sell them to your competition. I don't think that would happen, but still, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I bet it's that grubby CNET company wants to get its hands on my...
They want your interviews in advance, dude.
So they know where the security agenda's going, man. No, look, I mean, it's not just one for the tinfoil hat wearers. I think most people, even if they're they're not trying to hide anything, would feel quite violated having their hard drive searched, you know, their emails read. I just don't like it. And I think it makes a very good case for investing in some sort of secure thin client setup for when you're traveling. You know, pumping stuff through an SSH tunnel back to home so that you don't actually have to carry the stuff with you. I'm not sure what the legality is on having to hand over keys and things like that in encrypted setups. But the other thing you can do is use a hidden TrueCrypt volume when you're traveling. So just, you know, lock everything up that you want to be locked up and put it in a hidden volume. And that way, you know, I doubt the TSA is going to be cluey enough to actually open that up and find out what you got in there.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what they're using and how smart the bloke is that's actually, like, you know, looking through your laptop. But yeah, you're right, that probably gets right. But I think it's best to keep it all on your own server, really, and then access it when you want.
Okay, Munir, well, thanks a lot for joining us again this week on Risky Business.
Cheers, mate. Good talking to you.
ZDNet Australia's editor Munir Kataria there with a look at this week's headlines. Now, before I forget to mention it, there's an OWASP meeting in Sydney on the 14th of May. That's Wednesday next week. It's at 6 to 8pm at KPMG's auditorium, and the meeting will feature a technical presentation on flash application vulnerabilities by Paul Thuriot from SIFT. So if that's your bag, go and check it out. Back to the risky business at hand now, and it's time for our first feature interview on this week's show. And this week, I'm very pleased to bring you this chat with HD Moore. It's hard to find anyone in the security industry who's built up more cred in this business than HD. His Metasploit framework was extraordinarily controversial when he first uncaged it back in 2003. But these days, Metasploit is recognized as a vital tool for the good guys and a fine bit of development and engineering. Well, HD is working on something else which will probably create a similar stir. He's busy integrating Metasploit and a whole bunch of other goodies into the Karma framework. Dino A. Dazovi and Shane McCauley created Karma. It's billed as a set of tools for assessing the security of wireless clients at multiple layers. By passively listening for 802.11 probe request frames, Karma can work out which networks a client is trying to connect to. From there, individual clients can be targeted by creating a rogue access point for one of their probed networks or using a custom driver that responds to probes and association requests for any SSID. So you can basically get people to connect to you no matter who they're trying to connect to. Higher level fake services can then capture credentials or exploit client-side vulnerabilities on the host. And this is where HD is joining the party. And the idea behind the integration is to create an evil EPC. By the time he's done, anyone with an EPC and a 10dBi antenna can wander into a cafe and steal everyone's passwords. So HD, thanks for joining us, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this sounds like a project to create the world's most evil EPC.
Basically. Well, the EPC part is only part of it. The Karma project was started by Dino Dazovi with a little bit of work from Shane McCauley. Probably got his name wrong, but he does that K2. This was started, I think, it was 2003 or 2004, and presented at Cantech West and Microsoft Blue Hat. What this project did is it used a modified wireless access point, wireless driver, so that you can run an access point on your laptop, and that access point would respond to queries for any single SSID or network name. So no matter what network you're trying to connect to, you would connect to this access point instead. The other side of that is, when you connect it to different services, like you're trying to browse, you know, to Google or try to get your mail or try to access any web service, it would respond for all of those services and capture all of your credentials. So you can use it to exploit client-side vulnerabilities no matter what site they're trying to go to, just by kind of keeping the user in a little sandbox where you know where they're trying to go and where they're trying to talk to, and you can basically return exploits for everything they try to do.
So it was a man-in-the-middle thing, but you could inject, like, inline iframe stuff.
It's like that. So it's not so much that you're man in the middle. There is no man on the other end, but you're basically impersonating the entire internet to the user. So what I worked on was, so I took the original driver from Dino and took some patches from Robin Wood of DigiNinja.org and kind of rolled in a couple of my own patches, including the ASUS EEPC HAL patch, so it supports the Wi-Fi chipset there, and built kind of a new version of the driver that has kind of a standardized logging facility and made some of the output more consistent. So it's more of just a roll-up patch of the last 2 or 3 years of work. On the Metasploit side, we took all of the user land daemons that were part of the original Karma distribution. We wrote those as Metasploit auxiliary modules, so you can run them all from inside the Metasploit framework. Then we added new modules to it, so you can do things like capture outbound SMTP email. So the place where that's useful, let's say you're sitting on an airplane, and you know, you're watching a DVD, and you've got Outlook open because you're writing email, and you've got a bunch of emails in your outbound box. Well, what's going to happen is if you have ever connected to a non-secured access point and it's in your preferred network list in Windows and someone's running Karma on that plane, your laptop will connect to their laptop, thinking it's an access point. You'll get an IP address, and Outlook will be trying to deliver the email to its normal mail server. But since you respond to every single request for every DNS name, it'll connect to you and deliver the email to you, and you just take their email.
And I can imagine you can inject, you know, you can throw the kitchen sink at it in terms of exploits, right?
Right. I mean, anything they try to do, whether it's browse the web or download email or, you know, connect via Instant Messenger or any other service that uses authentication, you can capture the authentication. You can do really evil things with regard to web pages, especially because there's so much of what you do online is secured in the browser based on what site you're going to. Mm-hmm. For example, anytime that you get a cookie from a website, only that website's allowed to read that cookie. But what happens when you connect to a server that responds for all websites and redirects you to all websites? Well, you're going to send that secured cookie to every one of those websites, which are all technically the same server. So one of the recent improvements to the software for the Karma and Metasploit combination is that whenever you try to browse to any website, it returns back a list of the top 500 websites that's currently listed at Alexa.com. And the first thing it does is your browser will try to connect to each one of those 500 sites. They all keep resolving back to the same host name, and each of those requests coming back in have all of your saved cookies for that site. Hmm. So really quickly, we can steal every cookie you have from the top 500 sites listed on Alexa.
Yeah, well, I imagine that'd make it, you know, nice little session theft trick there.
Yeah, exactly. You've got sessions, you've got user IDs, lots of good information. But what you don't have at that point are the actual passwords in most cases. Usually they're hashes or they're session IDs. So the next step is, how do we get the Firefox saved passwords out of all the browsers? So I took the same list of the top 500 sites. I wrote a quick Ruby script that would go through to each one of those sites and scrape all the different forms out of the web pages and save them off into a little directory that's built into a directory that's part of Metasploit, containing all the forms from the sites. So essentially, you're taking all the form information that the user normally type their username and password, et cetera, into, and saving off little snippets of it for each one of the sites. Now what happens is, whenever the user browses to any of those websites, or browses to any site, and we inject those frames, making them go to all those websites, we return those forms. And the user's browser, if it's Firefox, will auto-populate, auto-fill in all those form fields. So things like saved usernames and passwords, any field that's been saved from one of these sites that you visited before. What's really useful for things like MySpace logins, Facebook, banking websites will indicate what state you're in, things like that. So what happens is we also inject a little piece of JavaScript code back into those pages with the frames, with the forms, so that once the page has been processed, all the different values are populated in the fields, the JavaScript will then take those field values, post it back to the Metasploit server, and then save it all in the database. So it's essentially stealing all of your passwords and all of your cookies for all 500 of those websites.
That is evil.
And it's pretty effective. I mean, there are very few clients that do it. If you're not using Firefox, let's say using Internet Explorer, you're actually even worse off because there's another technique used, which is based on SMB Relay. Essentially, it'll put a link to a network file share into the web page via image source equal --, a server name, --IP, et cetera. What'll happen if you're running Internet Explorer is it'll actually try to connect to that file share. So it'll try to do SMB authentication to the server.
And then you get the hash.
You get the hash, but the hash is keying it to challenge. And there's actually something better you can do. Instead of just getting the hash from the client, which is pretty easy to do, what we can instead do is connect back to the client, ask them for their challenge key, and then feed their own challenge key back to themselves. So what you're forcing them to do essentially is log into their own system.
Nice.
Once they've authenticated their own system, you disconnect the client side of it, and now you've got an authenticated SMB shell session on their machine. At that point, you can actually upload shellcode just by connecting to network shares, upload an executable containing whatever shellcode you want from inside Metasploit, and then use the Service Manager API to start that shellcode up, and now you've got a remote shell on that person's machine, and you didn't exploit a single vulnerability.
Just going back to the browser angle with Firefox and whatnot, that would require a user to actually go and attempt to browse two sites, wouldn't it?
They have to go to some site, and yeah. No matter what site they go to, we force them to go to all the sites. There are some cases where different clients will actually try to browse websites on their own. And if they're using the Internet Explorer engine or using the Firefox engine, which I guess is sort of rare if you use Gecko, but that would cause that to be loaded as well.
So I guess if someone's been in hibernation mode or something, they get on the plane, they open up their laptop, and even if IE or Firefox is even loaded in the background and like tries to do a refresh on a page or something like that, you've got them, right?
Absolutely.
So say I'm in row 20, right? I'm heading off from Austin to San Francisco, and you happen to be on the same flight with your magic little EPC. I mean, you're creating a distro here, aren't you? Which just installs on the E and does all of this stuff automatically. So automagically, I'm going to get pwned completely just by being on the same plane as you.
Yep. And for the most part, when people are running, like let's say you don't do anything but watch DVDs and that's it. A lot of times you'll see other software that's running in the background of the machine trying to do things like auto-update or check for new updates or download RSS feeds or get the weather or things like that. What I'm looking to now is trying to find ways to exploit all of those applications as well. One example that stood out was a certain antivirus will try to do an auto-update from an FTP server automatically in the background. But if I'm running an FTP server and that server had a bad update, what can I do? Symantec, Norton, McAfee, ePolicy, all these different systems of these enterprise agents to connect back to a single server to look for updates and to communicate kind of like host information and whether they need to, you know, download updates or get a new policy. I'm looking at different ways to kind of subvert those client-side agents right now as well, like giving kind of an invalid server response to take control of the machine through that as well.
So you're owning them through their security software?
Right.
That's like a whole new level of evil.
Assuming I can find a way to do it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about in environments where there are actual valid wireless access points? So say I go down to my local cafe and you've actually followed me from San Francisco all the way to Australia because you really want my cookies. And you're sitting in the same cafe as me. I'm connecting to that, what is it, whatever, cafe wireless SSID, right? And you're sitting there with your little magic EPC. Is there anything you can do really there to force me to connect through you or not really?
Well, the EPC I use has a 10 dBi antenna, which is about 2.5 feet long. And this antenna generally overpowers anything else around it. So with being within 20 or 30 feet of you will be more than enough for your laptop to switch from the current cafe's wireless to my wireless because it has a stronger signal.
So while you're injecting stuff, you know, into my browser and you're grabbing cookies, you're grabbing stuff, you're making me fill in forms and doing all of that stuff. But in the meantime, you're actually sending me valid content as well, like in a sense, man in the middling or what? So I go to Google, I mean, I'm going through your EPC or am I just terminating there?
Well, right now the goal is to really build something that'll work anywhere, even if there isn't an existing network connection. And so it doesn't actually forward any traffic at this point. It's pretty simple to set up, so it could do that. But right now, I haven't seen much value in doing it because all the information I want to get, I don't need to forward it to get it.
Don't you think I might get a bit suspicious if I, you know, go to my local cafe and the wireless isn't working? Or do you think I'm just going to go to the waitress? Hey, the wireless isn't working.
Well, the way I've been solving it is the main page that displays when you try to browse the web brings up a little wireless login page. It says, oh, welcome to our wireless network. Please enter your guest credentials to log in.
Yeah, yeah. Please enter your credit card.
That could be a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So why are you doing this? Are you just doing this to, like, you know, piss people off?
Mostly this is the fun toy. The whole wireless access, wireless internet access thing has been just beaten to death by security researchers like the last 5 or 6 years. One thing that a lot of folks are doing now is really securing their access points. They've gone from WEP, which is easily crackable, moved on to WPA, WPA2, all sorts of other types of, you know, mutual authentication or token-based authentication for their access points. One thing that they haven't really found a good way to secure is the wireless clients themselves. So instead of going war driving or walking around looking for an access point, with this software, you go walk around looking for clients. So a good case study is even at my office here, we have folks who, even when they're not on the road, they've got the wireless enabled. So our CEO will sit down and he'll plug in his laptop to the Ethernet network, the regular wired network, but he still has his wireless enabled. So what happens is his wireless will join, you know, any access point that's in his list of, you know, preferred names. And since my software will spoof all that stuff, it'll automatically join one of those. At this point, I've got a connection to his laptop. His laptop now has connections to the corporate network. And if I can get a shell on his machine, I can now break into the rest of the corporate network. So basically every laptop with a wireless network card in it now becomes a new access point or at least one way to get into the wired network of the corporation.
So how do we fix it?
I mean, at this point, there's not really a good solution. One thing that we've seen that tends to solve it, at least from one perspective, is by just forcing every client to have a firewall on regardless of whether they're connected to the corporate network or not. The SMB relay attack doesn't work in that case. And as long as the outbound internet traffic to that machine keeps going through the wired connection and the firewall is up, there's really not a whole lot you can do. Mm-hmm. So that at least protects the machine in the case that they do join an access point that they're not intending to visit. What you can't really protect against is when you're on the road and you're just trying to find an access point to use to get online, you really are putting a whole lot of trust in whatever access point you join to take you to the right internet. There's nothing to say that any access point you visited before wasn't doing what I'm doing already. It just might not have been public.
Do you anticipate that when your little funky e-distro comes out that people are going to use it for evil?
I imagine so. if only for pen testing and assessments and whatnot, but I'm sure some folks will go out there and, you know, take it to the Apple store and watch the chaos ensue.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that this would be an incredibly popular tool at security conferences.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone's, you know, looking for a new wireless network, and at that point you're hacking hackers, so.
Yeah, I mean, have you used an early version of this at, like, you know, CANSEC or something?
If I have, I'm not going to say.
Nice. Well, HD Moore, I can imagine you right now doing a bit of a Dr. Evil sort of smile, but thank you very much for coming on to Risky Business.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Security researcher and developer HD Moore there, on the line from Austin, Texas. We're going to shift gear now into something completely different. Art Cavelio is the president of RSA Security, a company that turned over US$135 million in the first quarter of this year alone. Art was in Australia last week to meet with clients and the press. Now, RSA is a sponsor of Risky Business, but the following isn't a sponsor interview. It was placed into the show on editorial merit alone, and you're about to hear why. Last month, security pundit and BT Counterpain CTO Bruce Schneier used his column on Wired.com to declare the end of the security industry is nigh. And it kind of makes sense. You know, everything's so integrated these days. If you have a look at a ADSL router made for the consumer market, they actually come with stateful inspection firewalls and intrusion detection now. So security is more something that's baked in. Now, Schneier also took a poke at the RSA conference. So I asked Art Cavelio what he thought of Schneier's comments, both comments on the conference and on security being integrated. And as it turns out, it's not just his most recent comments that Schneier's made that bother the RSA president. He's clearly not a Schneier fan, and he used this interview to hit back.
I disagree with Bruce when he says stuff. You know, he says stuff to get quoted in the paper very often.
You think he's trying to get attention? Bruce hates attention.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, one of the things he said, right, is that one-time passcodes, which we're essentially the inventors of, right, can be defeated by man-in-the-middle attacks, right? And he, in essence, says that they're a little better than passwords. What a ridiculous statement to make. Your ability to launch a man-in-the-middle attack at event-based OTP, one-time passcodes, is difficult. Your ability to launch it against a time-synchronous one-time passcode where the code literally expires is theoretically possible and actually has been done. But man, oh man, it is really, really hard to do. So, I mean, Bruce talks out of both sides of his mouth. He'll tell you you can't have a perfect security system. And then when he sees any flaw in the system, he says, well, you might as well not even have it. So which is it, Bruce? You see what I mean?
I do see what you mean, but there are some valid criticisms of one-time passwords, particularly, you know, with the use of tokens. Before they were widely deployed, there wasn't a lot of effort didn't really go into, you know, thinking about how to get around them. But now that a lot of banks are issuing them to customers and things, we have seen the rise of these so-called man-in-the-browser attacks where you can, instead of hoarding username and password pairs for later use, you're actually doing a real-time login and doing real-time transactions and serving up false data to the user. I mean, you've got to admit that that does present a challenge to companies like RSA that make these sorts of products.
Of course it does. And we already have an answer for it. We call it transaction monitoring. So if you couple both of those, and I would never dispute the fact that you need defense in depth, but keep in mind, we know of only two instances where a man-in-the-middle attack on a one-time passcode has been successful. So again, you're never going to have perfect security systems, but what you want to have is defense in depth, and you want to make it harder and harder and harder. If you're going to have a perfect security system, you might as well shut down the internet altogether. So what we do with transaction monitoring is we look for anomalies in transactions and we stop them real time. So we've had that capability now for a couple of years, and Bruce never points out the fact. Again, he's an advocate for defense in depth. Well, Bruce, I'm giving you an answer. I've got defense in depth. You know, now what's your next question? And you know what? Somebody's going to say, well, you'll get around transaction monitoring. Okay, people still rob banks. Very few banks get robbed, right? But people still rob banks. You're not going to stop crime in the virtual world any easier or any more than you will have eliminated it in the physical world. But you certainly, you know, a a bank robbery these days is very much a rare occurrence. And I think as we get better and better, as we get more and more sophisticated, as we build security into the information infrastructure, we're going to keep tightening and locking this thing down. My view and the way I think security has to go is it has to go toward more behavior and content-based mechanisms that, to the extent possible, take the user out of the equation, that in essence do a lot of the thinking for the user. And I think that's where security is headed. And again, they could be products, or they could they'll be products, because to an extent it's products that are built into the infrastructure. I sometimes wonder, because I've gotten a couple of questions now. I must be following Bruce around Asia or something. But sometimes I wonder what he's getting at. Is he suggesting that the situation is hopeless, or what is he suggesting? I'm suggesting real answers here, and I'm trying to develop real solutions to solve these problems, and to the extent possible, build them into the infrastructure. I don't disagree. Quite frankly, I predicted the end of the security industry, and perhaps Bruce is mimicking me and saying, it's going to be the end of security products altogether. I do think that security needs to be built into the infrastructure, but there'll always be either security products or security components, and yes, there will absolutely have to be security experts.
Okay, well, Art Coviello, that is all we're going to have time for, but thank you very much for speaking to Risky Business.
It was a pleasure. Take care.
A very spirited Art Coviello there. He's the president of RSA Security. McAfee paid our bills this week so that we could bring you this show. God love them. So this week's sponsor interview is with their security research and communications manager from their Avert Labs, Dave Marcus. As it turns out, last week saw spam turn 30 years old. So let's talk about Spamonomics and McAfee's spam experiment.
It's a good time to talk about where it started from, how it started, and what the changes have been.
Wasn't it a job ad for Dell or something? Or Deck?
As a matter of fact, it was actually a product pitch for a Deck, a DEC computer, I think. You know, the guy that sent it out, Gary Thurk, I think is how his name is pronounced, got sales. He sold product as a result of sending out the spam. You know, so I think the first spam was almost kind of the model, right? You know, people didn't like it, but a percentage of them responded to it and bought product.
Well, this is the age-old problem with spam, isn't it? No matter how many filters you've got, no matter how much you prosecute people who do it, they're still going to do it if they can move their wares.
Oh, well, certainly. That's exactly it. I mean, when you bring finances and money into it, it really does change the game. There was a guy that I had read about, I think, last week on a news service here in the States who got 21 months in prison for spamming, and he actually had made $3.5 million in his spamming efforts. When you bring in monetary numbers like that, of course they're going
to
spam.
I bet he's got a few real estate brochures, to keep him company while he's in prison, counting down his sentence.
Yeah, he got levied with a pretty big tax evasion bill. He got like a $725,000 tax evasion bill.
That still leaves him with, what, 3.8 million? Something like that? 3.7
Something
million?
Something like that.
That's not
but
too
21
bad.
Months in federal prison is certainly no picnic.
Better than 21 months in a state prison. But anyway.
Yeah, that certainly is true.
So, okay, 30 years on, and people are still actually buying stuff from spam. Can your mind actually wrap itself around the sort of... Have you ever met anyone who's bought stuff from spam?
You know... No, I can't. I will be honest and say, I've followed spam for a long time, and I've always been surprised in many ways that it actually ever worked in the first place. When you look at how some of the original spams were sent out and how bad their grammar was, what bank uses bad grammar when it's messaging to someone, right? What company uses bad grammar, poor punctuation, and poor spelling? It just astounded me it ever worked in the first place, and I've never met anybody who bought anything through a spammer, but they're making money somewhere.
Yeah, I suppose their targets are people who can't detect bad grammar. People who use bad grammar themselves, and as a journalist for a number of years, my feeling, I'm a little bit biased in this instance, but I feel that people who can't detect bad grammar sort of deserve to suffer a little bit by buying things through spam. But you were mentioning...
I could certainly understand where you're coming from. It's just I always got amazed some of it worked in the first place. I mean, it took so long. And you know, I guess it's the simple thing that if something is working, you know, why change it, right? And they had just sent out that really poor quality spam with bad images for the longest time, and it worked. And then, you know, we finally started seeing, you know, evolution where you couldn't distinguish the spam from the real thing. And then you couldn't distinguish the phishing site from the real thing. So they finally got a bit more sophisticated as I think users got more sophisticated.
The crafty devils investigated dictionaries.
Yep.
It's terrible. Now, you were telling me before we started the interview about some sort of global spam experiment. Please explain.
Yeah, you know, this really came about as a way of wanting to show people graphically that spam is more than just this nuisance. You know, it's more than just this nebulous thing that clogs up your in-mail that clogs up your inbox. And we wanted to show them in a very experiential way. So we came up with the idea of this spam experiment, and what we decided on was 30 days. We would take 5 people from 10 different geographies, you know, so not just be U.S.-based. We wanted to be global in nature because, you know, it's a global problem. So we found 5 people in the U.S., in the U.K., in Australia, in Brazil, in Germany, all these different areas. And we gave them a brand new out-of-the-box Dell laptop, set them up with a brand new email address, and basically told them that we want them for 30 days to do everything we usually tell them not to do.
Like enter your email address into pornography sites.
Not just pornography sites, but, you know, we wanted them to go to places, you know, that were known sites to send out certain types of emails, known sites, known pharmacies, you know, screensaver sites, sports sites, celebrity wallpaper sites, you know, places that are known for harvesting email addresses.
Oh, man, I feel dirty just thinking about that.
You know, it is, but, you know, we kind of did it in a very tongue-in-cheek way. You know, we kind of took Morgan Spurlock's idea, you know, when he did the 30 days of living on fast food kind of thing, you know, that kind of, you know, super spam me or you know, supersize me that he had done. So the other side of the experiment was having the participants blog on a daily basis about what was happening. How much spam were they getting? Who were they getting it from? What kind of messages were being sent to them? You know, those kinds of things. So the analysis and collection side of it is one part of it. But the other side of it is the people actually sharing their experiences. And some of them were just, I mean, zealots about going out and wanting to hunt down and expose these spammers. I mean, some of them would just write these wonderful blogs on how bad these people are. You know, my inbox had 750 emails today. I mean, it was a great experiment. It really turned out very well.
So really, what, you were just torturing these people?
No, not at all. You know, they knew going into it that the only thing they were really asked to commit was they were asked to commit an hour a day. You know, an hour a day to surfing and putting this email address out there, you know, and responding to spam and, you know, then blogging about it. So we only actually asked for an hour commitment a day. But a lot of them who really had gotten into it certainly spent much more time doing it. You know, as they were getting in more spam and it was becoming more interesting, you know, they were spending more time sharing their stories and stuff like that.
So what was the purpose of the experiment?
The purpose of the experiment was to show that is not just a nuisance. We really wanted them to follow the spam trail so we can show people how it actually connects to crime, how people actually lose their credit, how they actually are scammed out of money, how they actually can have their identity stolen. So that was really the point, was to take it past the it's a nuisance, just delete it. We really wanted to show people what we're protecting them against.
Yep, okay. Well, Dave Marcus, thank you very much for taking some time out to help us celebrate, or at least mark, the 30th anniversary of spam.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. The structure that I'm leaving. Lady, I hear the sweet voice of
melody. I smell the sweet scent of evening. That was Dave Marcus from McAfee's Avert Labs in this week's sponsor interview, rounding out this edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is The Wisdom by Fingers Malone, and you can buy this track for $1.40 at soundfoundation.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Of desperation, a physically fluid installation, the monster we've created, the instant gratification. The system, I'm in it for the wisdom. I'm calm, calculated, and I utilize my vision.
Lady, I hear the sweet voice of melody. I smell the sweet sound.